This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Well, a big political show this morning. The Education Minister, Paul Given, is in the studio between 9 and 10 o'clock talking about education and what he has delivered and being challenged about what he promised to deliver and his future vision for our kids in Northern Ireland. After 10, Jimmy Bryson is on the programming, talking about that year ago when a key DUP meeting when Donaldson was selling, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson was selling the Safeguarding the Union deal. He was selling it to his own party in a private meeting, and Bryson ended up getting a live feed being sent to him of that meeting. So interesting stuff this morning on the biggest show in the country.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. So day in, day out on the Nolan Show for the last 20 years, we've been holding this government to account, both when they're in place and when they're not, the local politicians. And it's on Monday, it'll be a year since ministers were appointed to the current Stormont setup that we have. Have they delivered? Well, a year ago, Paul Given, the Education Minister, was one of the first into the Nolan studio, and he promised to come back a year later. And here we are today. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Good morning. So, have you delivered? Big question. I know you're going to spend a lot of time with us this morning. Thank you. But have you delivered?
Well, it has been a privilege to have served in this role now for 12 months. And I think when we look back on what we have achieved, I can be proud of the incredible work that has went on within my department right across the education system. And I have now visited 150 schools. I have had engagements with countless numbers of people, over 600 public-facing engagements. And then there's all of those other meetings internally. And I get to see firsthand the opportunities that go on in our schools to try and develop those young people, to give them the best opportunities in life.
And look, Paul, this isn't a PR exercise for you today, so I am going to challenge you. But I think sometimes local politicians feel that all they get is challenged and they don't get an opportunity to say, well, look, here's what we have done. Here's what we have achieved. So what are your big achievements?
Well, headline achievements, in my view, the early learning and childcare, huge priority that was placed upon me by the executive and my own party, the DUP. It was a manifesto commitment that we would deliver on this. We now have 14,500 children registered getting support to meet those costs. That's £160 per month. It's a 15% subsidy. We built it upon the tax-free allowance that the UK government have. And that now has delivered over £5 million of savings into hardworking families. But we're also taking through...
But is it enough when our parents sorted?
Well, I want to do more, so it's not enough. But the challenge that I had was, what are you going to do and how do you get this established? So I had to create a new subsidy scheme. We've also taken through standardised nursery school provision. Only 40% of children that go to nursery school or a preschool setting that year before they go into P1 get a full-time place, which is 22 and a half hours. The majority of children only get 12 and a half hours. That isn't fair. It also impacts on childcare cost, but it also, in my view, undermines their education. So we have now put through over 100 settings, increasing them to full-time places. 2,500 children will start in full-time preschool settings in the 1st of September. So that's been important. Sure Start, another organisation.
Just before we move on to that, so what does the evidence suggest, the data suggest, in terms of how important is it to get that preschool nursery education help?
Hugely important, because if we're going to have that intervention in those early years, we need to then provide the opportunity to actually get working with those young people. So make the early intervention, provide them with that educational support and other support that they may need. That means they will have better outcomes and it requires less intervention when they're later in life in the schooling system. So the focus on early years is a really important piece of work. And Sure Start is an organisation that works in disadvantaged communities. They came to me and said, Paul, we are struggling. We are losing staff. Support us. And I put in place support, not only to stabilise, but to bring in areas that were on temporary support. They're now part of the permanent work, and that is helping young people with disadvantage, which is hugely important. So early years childcare has been a big part of what I have.
What are you saying you've delivered?
14,500 children now registered on a child subsidy scheme.
More than, well, what was it before you came in?
Well, there wasn't.
But what were people doing is my point.
Well, there was, they were getting 20% for those that were available, the UK tax-free scheme, towards meeting their costs. This is a brand new scheme set up from scratch that I had to take forward, and my team and the department worked incredibly hard to do it. And that was established within months. So that has been a big success, the preschool places supporting Sure Start. And other things that I've taken forward has been settling teachers' pay disputes. And that is one that your show has covered with.
It's not settled yet. Now, sources are telling me that you'll be announcing quite soon a settlement, 5.5% for the teachers. Am I right?
Well, we're close to finalising a resolution in terms of this current financial year. And that will come through, I would hope, within the next day, next week. I'm making progress.
And the reason I'm mentioning the 5.5% figure, because that would be akin to across the water, wouldn't it?
Yes.
You're going to give teachers here parity.
In England, that was the figure that was settled upon by their pay review body. We have a different negotiating framework here in Northern Ireland. It is not part of a UK-wide process. And I've had to try and identify funding, which has been really difficult given the pressures that exist within my department to try and get the funding that I need this year. But that will be, I trust, resolved soon. But when I came in,
before you move on, the unions had been asking for 13.5%, something that you said was unachievable. But you've just said today, and I guess there's the a hint of the first breaking story from this interview already with 2 minutes in. If you're about to make an announcement within a day, then, you know, the journalist in me says you've got agreement or you're close to agreement with the unions at 5.5%.
Well, we have been engaging with the unions for the past number of months. That has intensified during January, as you would expect, whenever we have a better understanding of the financial resources available to me. And it's a negotiation, and it's one that we are making progress on, and I hope to be able to come to a conclusion. But when I came into this
room, the next day. Friday.
Yes, within the next number of days, I would hope that we will be able to bring this matter to a conclusion.
Okay.
But I have to respect the processes that the unions
sure.
need to go through. But that will build upon. When I came into office, new graduates in Northern Ireland who went into the teaching profession were starting on £23,000 a year. In England, it was £30,000. Part of the negotiation that I got to support our hardworking teachers, whom I believe deserve fair pay, they got over 10% of an increase after I came into office. That was a significant uplift in their pay. Backdated amounts were also provided. But new recruits had a 24% increase because I want our young people to stay in Northern Ireland, not to look across the water. And they now get paid £30,000 a year. So we've delivered on teachers' pay. I hope to be able to build upon that within the next number of days. And also we had a pay and grading review for our support staff. And I've listened to your classroom assistants come on this programme. I very much value them. And that's why we secured another agreement with the unions to support not just classroom assistants, but our bus drivers, our cooks, our cleaners in our schools. And that has been delivered during my first year in office.
Well, the classroom assistant that you're about to hear here, I actually said to her this week, I hope the minister is listening. She certainly doesn't feel that there has been delivery to the point. And there was a survey, wasn't there, by the Ulster University, which stated, you know, over 1,000 classroom assistants signing up to suggesting that they're treated and feel like dog's bodies and underpaid. Let's have a listen to what this lady, Donna, told us.
Education Board, the government, I feel that we're completely left out and forgot about. I have been working for 20 years and because I'm on such a low contract, I cannot change to a 52-week contract where there's people coming in that are not working as long as me, and they can change to a 52-week contract. If I was to change to a 52-week contract, it would change my pay grade, and then I would have to take even less pay. I have to take on a second job to make up my pay and also to try and fill in the blanks from the holidays, and then as well, because it's classed as a second job, which you're getting minimum wage for anyway, but they tax you on that because it's two jobs.
She's on £14.50 an hour. Is that consistent with the job a one-on-one classroom assistant does with a child and the life-defining experience a child will have from a good assistant?
Well, it's why I took through the pay and grading review business case to support and increase the pay that our classroom assistants do get. Do classroom assistants want to have more? Yes, they do.
Are you going to give them more?
Well, we just concluded the pay and grading review, which was based upon the ability to recruit and retain our classroom assistants. That funding has been provided, tens of millions of pounds additional provided in year, and that will year on year be built into people's pay. So I have recognised the valuable contribution our classroom assistants carry out.
I still feel like they're undervalued, underpaid. And it's the Education Authority, ultimately.
They're the employer, and I know they were on the programme talking through some of that contractual related issues. But I wanted to say as a minister, as I did whenever I was with the University of Ulster, I was there for the launch of that report. I very much deeply value the work that our classroom assistants carry out.
But that doesn't pay the bills. You valuing them does not pay the bills.
Well, and that's why I took through the pay and grading review. So I worked with the trade unions. This was another negotiated settlement in order to increase the pay so that we can recruit and retain. But of course there are challenges in getting people into the workforce. I've heard them from principals. And we do need to look at how we're supporting our children with special educational needs. And over the past 5 years, there have been a significant increase in the number of statements, the number of one-to-one provision. And when I meet with principals, they say to me, Paul, I can't recruit. There isn't the workforce out there to do it. But what principals are now doing, and a number of our big post-primary schools, they're utilising resources to employ a full-time teacher, to have smaller opportunities to work with young people. And they're saying to me, Paul, this is working for the educational benefit of those children. We're getting really good outcomes. And it reflects the reality that whenever we try and recruit classroom assistants, it's really difficult in the current economy where we're pretty much at full employment to get people in. But I'm looking at this process. And what will motivate me is, what is the best model to support our children and young people? How do I provide that flexibility for principals to make sure that educationally we're supporting our young people?
I keep on boring people by referring back to, you know, the stories I was doing since CityBeat, but I'm trying to make the point that there are some issues in Northern Ireland that go constantly round and round in circles. And you know, I was broadcasting the Northern Show on CityBeat 20-odd years ago to give that context. So, look, one of the issues, and it came up in that clip there, is that what we do to some, and we describe it as choice, what we do to some classroom assistants in Northern Ireland is they're maybe such valued members of staff that they're trusted to be within the same school with vulnerable children for 10 or 15 or 20 years. And yet every June, their employment stops. Every September, their employment starts again. And guess what? They don't get holidays. How do you live your life like that? And then let's look at all our politicians. Oh, none of them stop in June and start in September. So the people at the bottom of the earning cycle, they have fewer rights, less stability than the people at the top. Is that fair?
Well, I think the analogy isn't correct because I certainly don't get off in July and August whenever Stormont isn't setting.
Yeah, but your employment is not terminated, is my point.
But I get the point that you make. It's the same for teachers whenever schools are closed, but the contracts that they're on, obviously pay is made over 12 months. And these are the contractual issues that the EA have been looking through, because different contracts will pay different rates based upon that 12-month period or whether it's term time period. So those are contractual issues whenever it comes to people's pay. But listen, what I have said...
You get the point I'm putting to you.
I do get the point.
How do you get the best people if they're on, you know...
But it's also about what is the best model for our children?
You tell me.
Well, this is the point that I'm making, and I would encourage you to go out and speak to principals in schools that are now utilising full-time teachers, small class settings, small groups. And what my focus has to be upon is the educational outcome for children so that we can create high levels of independence for them, and also educational outcomes. And we are looking through that process for supporting children, particularly those with additional needs. And before you even get to the point that parents are crying out for a statement, a legal document, in the view that that will provide them with the resources, when often it actually doesn't, we need to be supporting children long before parents are desperate and crying out for help. And there are different ways in which now we are providing that support. I've been in schools, I've been able to see it for myself, and I've heard from principals who have said there is a better way of providing support for our children.
And are you saying that better way is for us to essentially create dedicated focused classroom with fewer pupils in it who need that special assistant and specialists in that?
Yes. That's what I have.
A specialist teacher and a specialist classroom assistant, or what?
We increasingly have nurture units taking within our primary schools, small settings, helping those children. And we're seeing it in post-primary schools now as well, where you can have that smaller setting and provide that more direct support. And that's getting good outcomes for those children and being commended to me by those on the front line by our principals that can see it.
So I know, Paul, that one of the areas that you feel passionately about is you're asked lots of questions about what are you doing, and there are important questions about infrastructure, about school buildings, for example. But there's another vital question, which is what are you actually doing about what's being taught inside them?
Yes, and it is hugely important that we can get a school estate that is fit for purpose. And there has been many a report, the Northern Ireland Audit Office has said, and I agree, underfunded and requires hundreds of millions of pounds to improve the physical capacity in our schools.
How many of the proportion of our schools, what percentage of the proportion of our schools are not fit for purpose?
Well,
in terms of the building,
I wouldn't say
in
that.
In terms of the infrastructure.
It's not that they're not fit for purpose, because health and safety is paramount, and therefore our funding goes towards ensuring that, but that is the priority when it comes to funding. But there are many schools that are waiting to be awarded a contract to move into construction, and we can't do that because there hasn't been the funding provided for those capital works.
Okay, so how many schools require capital works of the percentage we have?
Well, there are in excess of 50 schools that are waiting to be taken through towards a construction, whether that's a school enhancement programme or a new build.
But would any of us be shocked if we saw the state of any of those schools?
Yes.
What would we see?
Well, I went in, one of the first schools that I visited was in the Shankill, and it was appalling in terms of the windows, damp in the school. You could feel it, you could taste it, the mould, and the school have been doing a really good job in appalling facilities.
When did you go in there?
It was one of the first schools that I visited in office, so it would have been within a week or two, but they were on the list. It was one of the schools that I have been able to take through to get a new build. And there were seven new schools that I've been able to take through towards a construction, and it was one of them. But it was outrageous, in my view, the conditions that they were having to deliver education in.
And your party's got to own that, because your party, when there has been a government, has been part of the government here for many, many years.
Well, I very much own the responsibility now to champion the needs of our schools, and I'm out and I'm doing that, and I push hard for funding. At times, to the frustration maybe of some of my own colleagues, that I'm pushing so hard for education, because everybody has financial pressures in their departments. But education is so vitally important for the life chances of our young people.
And I want to get on to the teaching in a second, but in terms of the infrastructure then, I noticed that you said in excess of 50 schools, which could mean anything. It's a good politician's answer.
Well, it's so, because, Stephen, I don't have the precise figure.
But is it around 50?
So it's over 50, but they are in the pipeline of school enhancements or new builds. Yeah. And I can't take them forward. And therefore, I haven't been able to go out and say there are other schools who need to have a new build, who need to be enhanced. But because there's so much work currently in the system, it's going to take at least a decade, if not more, just to, at the current rate of spend, to deliver on what we currently have to get through by way of new bills.
Are there many schools, Minister, where children are going in to damp
mould every day of the week, and that's their school experience? Because I'm ignorant about that. Are there many?
No, I wouldn't say that there's many, but I have, and schools are always working and we're always trying to help them with the maintenance. But I have visited schools where they've taken me into parts of the building where there is mould and it's not good enough, and they have to then close off a particular room if it's not accessible for them to do. So there is not enough funding that goes in to the capital needs within our schools by way of general maintenance. But we are still taking forward as best we can the works. And one of the reasons has been around even the provision of special educational needs. When I came into office, I was told there were over 1,000 children that didn't have a place in September. We've spent £51 million to provide additional capacity. I was at a school yesterday, which I visited a year ago, which didn't have it, asked for it, we've delivered on it, and we created 1,450 places. So the challenge in education is immense. The resources are not sufficient, and therefore I have to do as best as I can within that context.
So I think in the first 20 minutes of this interview this morning, there may very well be quite a few people thinking, there's a passionate minister. He's talking about, you know, his primary care is for the education, the support of all children in Northern Ireland. And then I look at one of the decisions, Minister, that you made around integrated education. So Bangor Grammar School and indeed Rathmore Primary School, Bangor Academy, sorry, and Rathmore. So the majority of parents supported those schools becoming integrated. Your officials recommended it. The Education Authority recommended it. The Controlled Schools Council recommended it. And here we had a DUP minister, a unionist minister, saying no.
Well, I look
What does that smell of?
Well, It says that whenever I've approved development proposals to transform into integrated settings, I have approved them. I've approved more than I've refused. But each individual school gets looked at in their particular context. It's well publicised, the rationale in terms of those two particular schools.
So your rationale in these schools I'm talking about has got to be the majority of parents' views don't matter enough. Your own officials are flawed and their thinking screwed up, as is the Education Authority, as is the Controlled Schools Council. And you're right and everybody else is wrong.
Well, I look through in detail all of the proposals that come to me, as I did with these two particular ones. And within the reports of both schools, the reasonable numbers were not there. Less than 3% of a minority community that made up the pupil population. But I didn't just leave it at that. We look at, you know, the case for change and how likely is it to get reasonable numbers. And there wasn't evidence within the case for change that showed that it was going to be likely either. So to put it in,
let me give you the numbers. Let me give everyone the numbers. So for Bangor, for example, 1,084 children were Protestant, 54 Catholic, 697 other. Rathmore, 302 Protestant, 17 Catholic, 264 other. But when you have the majority of all those different interested groups saying, at least let us try, what's the harm in letting them try? Designating themselves as integrated, reaching out, trying to improve those numbers.
But, and again, integration formally needs to be more than just a name. It has to have evidence and demonstrate that you are an integrated school. Both schools are...
Does it not have to have evidence that you're wanting to try?
Let me explain this, Stephen. Both schools have said, and I support, are inclusive and open to all. Every school that I visit, controlled, Catholic maintained, Irish medium, all say they're inclusive and open to all, okay? And I welcome that, and I support all of our schools being inclusive, open to all, and there is a rich diversity that exists in controlled schools, in Catholic maintained schools. I've been there. Whenever you want to become a formally integrated school, I think people recognise that as very much the deliberate and intent purpose behind Protestant and Catholics. That is the traditional understanding of what it is to be an integrated
Correct.
School. And I don't think it is reasonable to say that a school that has less than 3% of a minority community, whether it's a Protestant or Catholic minority, I don't think it is reasonable when the legislation says, and this is what I am bound by, the legislation brought through the Assembly in 2022 makes it explicitly clear in section 1-1A, there must be a reasonable number of Protestants and Catholics. I didn't introduce that legislation.
The same legislation, Minister, because I looked at it, also says that criteria you've just given should be considered as just one of the guiding criteria. Just one. And are you trying to tell me you didn't have ministerial power to say if you had wanted that to be integrated, it could have been?
Well,
with the parents, with your own officials, with the education authority recommending it? Let's just address the elephant in the room. It's the Nolan Show. You're a DUP minister. The accusation is you're trying to protect Protestant-dominated education in some type of way. You know that's the accusation.
It's a false one. But
how are your own officials getting it wrong as well?
Well, officials can answer for themselves. I looked at the report that they provided and took a decision based upon the content within that. So I think it is reasonable for me to conclude that a school that has less than 3% of a minority population that hasn't provided the evidence that that is likely to change would be deemed to be an integrated school based upon the statutory legislative provisions that I've just highlighted to you that the Assembly voted upon. I'm not interested.
Would it not help if it was integrated?
So here's the point that I want to make more broadly. I want every school to be inclusive. I am not remotely interested in some kind of religious headcount within a school. I never go into a school, nor would I teach my own children to go into the school and think about the colour of the skin of another pupil or the religious background of another pupil. I want them all to be inclusive. And
see, using the word inclusive rather than integrated. Why would you not want every school in Northern Ireland to be integrated?
Well, I do want them to be integrated, inclusive schools. But what you're saying is that only schools that have an official integrated badge attached to them somehow can be regarded as integrated inclusive schools. That is not the case. I have been in many schools, one in Bangor, St Columbanus, a Catholic maintained school with a very high level of the Protestant community attending it. I have been in controlled schools which have got much higher levels of religious integration than some formally integrated schools. And to give you a figure for that, there are 67 primary control schools that have a higher level of religious intake than some controlled integrated primary schools. So we have to move away from the notion that Catholic maintained controlled schools equals segregation and only integrated schools somehow are inclusive. That is not the case. And I meet principals and they find that concept offensive, that somehow their schools are not inclusive. They are.
Well, can I ask the question in a more general way? Do you think any child anywhere in Northern Ireland, it's a better educational experience from them and it's a better start to their life if they're being taught alongside, if Protestants are being taught with Catholics and Catholics taught with Protestants? Do you think that should be the goal of every school?
Of course. And I challenge schools that if there are barriers within their own local community that people are bypassing their school, why is that? How do you address those barriers? How do you make them welcome in your school, irrespective of the particular sector that school aligns itself with? So schools are often a reflection of that locality and the demographic of that
government
locality.
Government can do something
and
about
as that
it,
changes, as that changes, a school should be reflecting that change. That's what I have witnessed in my own schools in Lisburn, which have an increasing diversity within them. They don't need to rebadge to become formally integrated, to be an integrated school. And that's the point that I think in a broad sense we need to look at. But then I do have to take decisions at an individual level based upon the information that I have and using the statutory legislation that I have. If people want to change the law, which the Alliance Party actually brought through the Assembly, they specifically specified Protestant and Catholics. I didn't introduce the headcount into that legislation. They did. And those who are advocating for a change wanted to be removed, then let them come forward and I'll happily engage in that.
Because I don't want to get into the technicalities of this, but can you just help me understand this? That your own officials would be well versed in the legislation And yet they were recommending something which you're telling me the legislation didn't allow to happen. Now, that does not add up. Then on top of your own officials, the Education Authority, the body who we rely upon to understand the law and the rules, they also recommended it. So it doesn't add up to me how you're saying something was impossible to happen because of legislation. And your own officials in the Education Authority were saying this should happen.
Well, I don't agree with my officials' final analysis that they had on this.
Of the law?
Which... I'm the decision maker on this. So my
You told me the legislation prevented you from doing it.
And I don't believe that my officials give...
Understand the law.
They didn't give proper regard to the statutory responsibilities within the legislation.
And neither did the Education Authority?
So officials can speak for themselves.
But you're speaking about them this morning.
So I'm the minister. I take the decision. Unless you want us to go back...
Were you legally able to integrate those schools or not? Or do you stand by what you said 10, 15 minutes ago that the law prevented you from doing it?
Stephen, I've outlined in great detail the decision-making process on all of this. Ultimately, I have to take these decisions. Ministers take decisions, not officials. Unless you want to hand over our democratic institutions to unelected individuals, that would be a significant change in how we operate.
So the legislation didn't prevent you from doing it. You took the decision not to do it.
I take decisions on every single development proposal that comes to me. And on those issues, I have approved more schools that have wanted to transform to integrated status than I have refused.
You know, it's interesting, and let's if our colleagues are happy with it, let's just stand down and use them. We'll use our time this morning with the minister. I'm self checking myself here because here I am, 2025, challenging you about religion. I actually wonder if religion is as important to school children and parents as it maybe was in our era 10, 15, 20 years ago, because integration of thought, of how children view the important priorities in life, maybe isn't actually about religion. It's about social issues. It's about
Absolutely.
Who they want to be among in their schools,
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Thankfully, Stephen, I haven't been in any school where the pupil has talked to me about Protestant and Catholic.
Is that a good thing?
That's a wonderful thing, because that's the kind of society I want, where people are colourblind and blind to one's religion. I absolutely believe people have the right to have their religious beliefs. I have it. But when it comes to our children and young people, are we not wanting to create that shared society where those things aren't as important as maybe they were 50 years ago? And look at the decision that I took to advance the OMA campus in Struil. 6 new schools, 4,000 pupils from different religious backgrounds. What is going to be an iconic education campus in a town that suffered one of the most heinous acts of violence during those terrorist campaigns? And now we're sending a message about the future of Northern Ireland, a shared space, respecting difference. That's what I want in our education system. But what I also want...
They're separate schools in the same site, Minister, aren't they?
Shared education.
Separate schools on the same site.
Again, you and others need to move away from the stereotypical view, which is offensive to people, that a Catholic maintained school and a controlled school are not open to all. They are. I encourage people, go and visit those schools, because you are mischaracterising them. I find it offensive, as the Education Minister, on behalf of over 1,000 schools in Northern Ireland, that people would somehow characterise those schools as providing a segregated education. They don't. They provide an inclusive education, open and welcome to all.
Of course, I didn't say segregated. Just while we were talking there about religion, should pupils be required to go to prayer sessions at assembly? Or not? Or can they opt out? Should there be a more wider approach to diversity of opinion around abortion in schools, around some of the other issues sexuality? I'm trying to get into curriculum here and teaching in an environment for a child that doesn't really care with the label of broader Catholic.
It's interesting that you go into this area, because I find it remarkable that a lot of the conversation goes into issues which are at the margins of what goes on in our schools, important as they are, okay? But what about curriculum on English, maths, science, geography? And we've now been here for 40 minutes, And we haven't actually got in to what is the most fundamentally important parts of our education system. So
I think that's fair. So let's do it.
On those points, I am so thankful for people that go into our schools that provide that wider pastoral support for the contribution that churches make to our education system. I am thankful. I believe they should be involved. I support them being involved. But when it comes to schools, 99% of what goes on in our schools is on curriculum, assessment or qualification.
So let's talk about curriculum.
How we improve our schools.
Let's talk about curriculum then. You've been a year in situ. What big ideas have you around teaching?
So if this all comes back to what drives me as an education minister in supporting our children and young people, and how do we close the attainment gap of the haves and the have-nots, often marked out through social disadvantage in terms of the differential that you can see. The best opportunity that we can give those young people in life is their school experience. What gets taught in the classroom, how it's being taught in the classroom. And I've announced a review into our curriculum. A lady, Lucy Crane, has been taking it forward. We're 2 months into that. It will report on the Northern Ireland curriculum at large. And then flowing from that, we'll take forward specific new strategies, looking at what we've been doing, how we can improve it. Numeracy, literacy, the fundamental building blocks of education.
How do you teach people how to count differently? How do you teach them how to write differently?
Yeah, and that's a...
How do you?
So and that's a really good point, because how do we ensure that children have confidence in a subject matter, reading, writing, mathematics, and then how can we use those skills in other subject matters?
Give me examples of what you're looking at.
Well, so around literacy, the ability to read and write, what is the best approach? Is it phonics, sounding out those words? Is it looking at pictures on a page? Getting into the real nitty gritty.
Well, you tell me.
The science of reading.
Tell me.
Well, the evidence has shown phonics is the best approach. So you sound out the word, you know, cha, a, ta, chat. Okay. Rather than C-H-A-T, okay? The science behind reading and how people best read, as opposed to a system of providing cueing where there's a photograph maybe of an item and there's a missing part of the sentence and you're trying to figure that out. Evidence would show the best approach is to go down that phonetic route. And so,
and are we currently doing the old-fashioned model?
No, we largely are on the phonics model. But the evidence would show that we really need to focus on that. And so I'm getting into the weeds of what is the science behind the best approaches to reading? How does cognitive behaviour, the way the brain works, and how can that be taken through in the resources that we provide our schools? So I will take forward strategies on numeracy and literacy. We need to be able to assess what goes on across Northern Ireland.
More exams for kids then? More pressure on kids, more exams.
No, I think what we actually need to get...
Is that what you're saying, though?
In all schools, children are being tested, okay? So this happens. It's part of the education experience to be able to know how people are performing.
But, yeah, but you've got to protect children from too much. There's a line, isn't there? There's surely... I'm interested in what you think the line is.
Well,
so here... You've got kids.
I've three.
Right. So yeah. I don't... You're much more informed than this than I am.
So I have...
The pressure that some children can be under at exam time.
I know.
You want them to enjoy their life too. So
of course, how do
you find the balance?
Of course I do.
Where do you, as the powerful man in the middle of this, find the balance between examination... And you are saying more examination now, aren't you?
No. Well, if I can explain what I'm trying to do on this, because okay. I've just said that schools are constantly carrying out assessments of how children are performing. But at a system-wide level across Northern Ireland, we don't have data. Until GCSE results are announced, we know how children have performed whenever they're 16 years of age. What about Key Stage 1 when you're 8? Key Stage 2 when you're 11? Key Stage 3 when you're 14? How do we know at a Northern Ireland-wide level on things like numeracy and literacy, people are performing? Not every child will sit the transfer test. So again, what about those children who don't do that? And if we have measurable data, then that means we can inform the best resources that we need to provide. How do we support professional learning for teachers to make sure that they are able to develop their skills and ability to make the impact. And that's key for my next 12 months, one of my key priorities, looking at our curriculum, how we teach in certain subjects, numeracy, literacy. How do we support our teachers with training, freeing them up so that they can train?
Let me understand.
That's going to be really important.
I want to talk more about that. Let me understand, because I think this is new. You're saying this morning that you want to introduce, for the reasons you've outlined, some more key points in a pupil's life where you will gather the data as to how well they're doing, right? So my processing of that in my brain is, the question is the data that you will get worth the extra stress the child will go through being formally examined? Now, that's a fair question, because you can say all you like, if a child is going in for an exam where the data is going to be so important to come back to government,
but there's
then how are you protecting the child from that,
Stephen,
with that?
This does not determine what school a child is going to go to. It'll be a low stakes in that respect.
Schools will want to perform well at those exams.
This information is to inform the department. This isn't going to be something that there will be a league table created. That's not what it's about.
Okay, so
there will not be a public facing,
right,
here's the results of our assessment processes. Okay. This is about informing my department, the professionals that are involved in different organisations to support education, that whenever we're spending billions of pounds, that we're doing that effectively.
So age eight, extra exams at what age?
When you say extra exams,
right, what way do you want to describe them?
All right, don't mischaracterize.
What way do you want to describe them? I'm just interested in gathering from you again the ages.
We are working with SEA to develop a way in which we can assess numeracy and literacy at key stage 1, 2, and 3.
What age is that?
That's 8, 11, 14, and in a way that does not add any burden upon teachers and does not add stress to children.
So let me go with that, right?
What that provides us with will be measurable data to inform the best use of our resources.
And that's what I want to get to, you see, because let's run with your theory that you can do that and we'll not label it as extra stress, that it's valuable information. Then the key question for you is, with that information, what do you promise to deliver back with that extra data? What are you going to do? Have you got the money to do it? And do you promise you're going to make a change?
Because all of this helps us to develop the right resources. Where do we need to provide support? How do we...
Can you afford it?
Well, we can't afford to be spending billions of pounds in a way that may not be the best use of that funding. Any organisation that does not monitor and assess what it is doing to ensure it does it better is failing.
So let me try to make this real. So at age 8 or age 11, there's no extra pressure on the children, but what there is valuable data where the department can see what are you looking for, a trend in an individual pupil or a school. And if you see a trend in a school where a school is underperforming, are you going in and giving that school help, given that data? Are you targeting individual children, or how would it work? Or do you not know yet, which might be fair enough as well?
So we're developing it in terms of the process for carrying out the assessment. But this is not going to be high stakes, high pressured on the pupil or the school.
No, I'm saying, what are you going to deliver?
I've just outlined what I'm going to deliver.
For that, with that data, there's a school that's underperforming.
So
what would you do with it?
Well, it is more about making sure that in how we're supporting the profession at large, what are the resources that are being used? The material that's being used? How do we ensure that that's effective? How do we help tailor our teacher professional learning? Where are the areas that we need to focus on within these areas of numeracy and literacy? All of that will help inform us in the way that we can develop the education system, because we have to make that change and difference in our children and young people. It is too late to be monitoring when you get GCSEs. They're finished school. So it would be irrational and illogical not to have system-wide information around assessment in these key areas of numeracy and literacy. And so we need to really do that. And if we're going to be serious about tackling disadvantage and supporting schools, we have to know and provide that. And one of the important aspects of resolving industrial relations, the inspectorate are now able to go back into schools. For years, we did not have inspections in our schools.
And have we suffered from that?
Yes, we have. Undoubtedly we have. I've read the reports of some findings by our inspectorate. The inspectorate is there to provide that information, but also then what support needs to go into a school so that we make sure the life chances of our children and young people are being supported. And the people that need that most come from poor backgrounds.
So a lack of inspection in some schools, obviously you're not going to name the school, but what type of things have you been worried about seeing that hasn't been there because of a lack of inspection?
Well, some of the inspectorate have found really good practice, and that's important to share and disseminate that amongst other schools and to recognise that good practice. But there have been some concerning reports as well whenever it comes to how schools are performing, and that'll require external support to be provided within those schools. We can only do that whenever an inspection takes place.
Are we talking about things here like what?
Well, it comes to things like actually making sure schools are open in terms of the hours that they need to be open.
But they're required to be open. Some schools weren't.
Well, when it comes to, you know, different practices within the school, things have been identified that have required support to be put in place, including external support. That has been a result of resolving the industrial action because we need to be able to support schools.
We talked a year ago about school uniforms, Minister. What the value is of a school uniform, what the pressure is of a school uniform. And you promised to look at it in your first week in office. We're a year in. Are you going to make any change?
So we consulted on that in terms of proposals. A huge engagement. Over 7,500 people responded. A lot of young people responded to give their views. The overwhelming responses to that favoured strengthening the law on these issues. And so putting on a statutory footing, given legal power behind the guidance, that will be taken forward now in legislation. One of the areas as well people have spoken about is the number of items that make up a school uniform, and the PE kits is a real concern that came through. Multiple PE kits, branded PE kits, that emerged as a more significant issue than even the uniform issue. Do we put in legislation a specific number of items to help curtail?
Now we're a year in, and I can't. So the question is not do we. My question to you is, what are you doing? You've had a year to look at it. What are you going to do?
And the one other aspect that people have asked around is, can we introduce a cap on the costs? And that's something that requires more work. But what I am going to do, I am going to include within the law the guidance being given statutory authority, a role for the inspectorate to monitor to make sure schools are doing this. And the overwhelming majority already do this, but we need to make sure everybody does. But we'll also take provision within the law that we could introduce a cap, we could prescribe the number of items.
So that would give ministerial power to
allow us to
impose a cap.
Yes, it would. And I have put forward, the executive approved the outline of this. For me, I've taken that forward. The legislation is now ready to go. I have a paper with my executive colleagues.
Is it agreed by the executive?
So they have agreed. The basis upon which this law has now been crafted has been agreed by ministers. What ministers now need to sign off on, I have signed off on the precise wording of the law. It's now with my executive colleagues, and I would hope that will be approved. I can then introduce that into the Assembly within weeks. My aim is to get this in law by the end of June.
Okay, so
then
by,
it starts, so, 1st of September.
Okay, so by the end of June, do you, as the Education Minister, want to impose a cap on what the maximum cost of a school uniform can be?
So what's important on that?
It's a yes or a no.
No, here's why we need to take first the power to introduce it. Because there are issues around some schools may look at a cap as a target to reach rather than to reduce it. We need to look at how this has worked in England, specifying the number of items.
No,
so I'm taking it forward, Stephen.
Well, yeah, but look, and what first you just said is logical, but at the very least, is it your view that there should be a cap on the maximum potential cost of a school uniform?
So until we have the evidence as to...
You've had a year.
Let me finish, Stephen. We need to get the evidence as to how a cap would work. What I am doing is future-proofing the legislation so that when you talk to me and say, right, you now feel that there has to be a cap, I don't want to be sitting here saying to you, well, I actually now need to take it through primary legislation.
Yeah, but here's who I'm asking the question on behalf of. I'm asking the question on behalf of the parents that you know exist and I know exist
who sit in a single parent family, or indeed a family where there are two people working and they can't even pay the bills. And they're getting hit with a PE uniform where there's got to be a specific badge. And by the way, your child can't play in this team. And it can only be bought from a single supplier. And so the straight question to you today, a year in, are you going to stop that happening?
Well, that's what we're taking through by way of legislation. So when you challenged me a year ago, what are you going to do? I says, I'm going to take forward all of this. That does require public consultation, engagement, getting executive approval, getting legislation crafted and introducing it to the Assembly. I'm at the final process now of sign off by my executive colleagues, legislation that I can introduce into the Assembly. And then MLAs, they will want to look at this. So this will continue by way of the debate and MLAs will be able to craft that legislation. That is me delivering on a promise that my party made that we would introduce legislation around uniforms.
In principle, do you support a cap?
In principle,
do you support getting rid of branded gear? These are the fundamental basic questions.
It works, absolutely. But we need to get the evidence that it'll actually work. But I am future-proofing the legislation by including provisions that this could then be given effect. So that's what I'm doing.
Do you feel powerful? And it's not a trick question in that. Does that power make you feel awkward in terms of there's a lot of responsibility with it? Do you feel frustrated that you don't have enough power? Or what's this ministerial job feel like, given the fact it's affecting, you know, all kids in Northern Ireland?
It's a huge privilege, but it has huge responsibilities. And I do feel the weight of that at times. You take even the decisions to close schools when the storm was coming in. And, you know, I was engaged on that, had to take the decision. It was the right one now, absolutely, to close schools. But then we had over 300 schools that had no power. How do we get them back? And the meetings I was engaged in trying to do that. When I go to schools and I hear and I share the frustration from principals wanting to get more support, I have to take that and try and do something with it. When I take decisions on schools, we've talked about two schools, two thriving, sustainable schools. I also took decisions to close schools, small schools and communities, principals devastated, families devastated. I feel that. But somebody has to take decisions. Not everybody can just be a commentator and say this is what they would want. Some people actually need to take that responsibility. And with that, some will agree with me, some will disagree with me. But that is the responsibility that comes with taking this job.
The responsibility of being a politician in Northern Ireland, as you know, is to try to be straight with your electorate. I want to ask you a wider question. Some people call it the Donaldson deal, which, by the way, was signed a year ago to the day. It wasn't the Donaldson deal. It was your party telling the people of Northern Ireland that the Safeguarding the Union command paper blocked all EU law coming into Northern Ireland. Sir Geoffrey Donaldson sat in front of your party officers and your party officer said, tell the people the storm and break works. There were incredibly influential household names within your party warning your party officers and your leader at the time and Gavin Robinson, do not do this. Did your party spoof to the public a year ago? And is it an issue of embarrassment now that we see that the storm and break doesn't stop EU law coming in to Northern Ireland?
And no, I'm not embarrassed at all about the work that has went into restoring these institutions. Gavin did say, and I agreed with him in terms of the way in which some of this was sold. I'm very straight with people as to what we can do. I also think we need to be clear with people.
Were people lied to?
No, I don't accept that.
So does the storm and break stop EU law in Northern Ireland?
So what the storm and break, and again, what we have delivered is much greater levels of democratic oversight when it comes to these issues. That's why there is now a committee at Stormont that looks at this. We pulled that break, but not the DUP exclusively. Every single unionist.
Yeah. And the British government said, yeah, but we don't think it meets the criteria.
You didn't
cut off EU law,
so,
did you?
Not for the first time the British government let down the unionist people of Northern Ireland.
It's not how you were selling it a year ago.
So here is the broader point, and we can get into the weeds of the Safeguarding the Union document, and that's fine. I'm happy to do that at any stage. But I believe in devolution, and I believe that we are best placed to take decisions on behalf of the people of Northern Ireland. And for those that would advocate, particularly those within the unionist community, let's go back to direct rule. The very same people who have refused to follow what we pulled in terms of the Stormont break, that's who you want to give us power back to. A government that time and time again has let the unionist people down. Direct rule would be a backward step for the unionist people. And here's why. If we're going to make Northern Ireland work for the union and keep Northern Ireland in the union, we have to deliver for people on a whole range of issues. That's why childcare, teachers' pay, supporting the curriculum, making sure we get the best opportunity for life. Because see, when people decide to vote in a referendum, it'll be how well do they feel in Northern Ireland we are supporting them. And I'm focused on making sure we provide that support.
We've about 90 seconds before the news. I want to leave your final opportunity to speak, not to get a lot of young listeners, right, particularly on after the show and things. I want you to speak to them about what your next promises are over the next 12 months. What are you going to do for them?
Well, my promise is to drive forward every single day reform in our education system to give them the best life chances possible. I was at a school, and I'll finish on this, this week, in Ballysally, a really challenging area in terms of social disadvantage, creating that aspiration. And I was with a principal who said, my pupils can be whatever they want to be, and I will support them every single day to have an aspiration to be better than what many people in society believe they can be. It's my job as a minister to support that principle and create much better life chances for those who don't have the best opportunities in life. And every day I wake up and say, what can I do today to drive forward on that agenda?
Minister, thanks for spending an hour with us. Will you do it next year again?
Well, I'm sure I'll do it throughout the year.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Paul. Thank you. Right, good morning. I see you calling in this, 0330 80 55 55. So to be fair, there's the Education Minister sitting down in front of you all on the Nolan Show for an hour, taking questions about what he promised at the start, what he has delivered, what he hasn't delivered, and some of the questions that you have had for him. If you want to go back and listen to the detail of that, recommend it to someone. It's on BBC Sounds. Straight after the programme, just search for the Nolan Show. Now, we were saying that it's a year on Monday, this Monday coming, when ministers signed up to this new Stormont setup that we have. Today marks a year since a top secret meeting held by the DUP leader at the time, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, where he pitched his controversial deal with the Westminster government to his own party. Now, that meeting was bugged in what was dubbed Operation Torpedo. A core group of six people, made up of five senior DUP members and Jamie Bryson, who tweeted the meeting word for word. And Jamie is with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Just before we get into what happened a year ago and the bugging and the one of the most interesting parts of it, people within the DUP helping you to wire up that meeting. You've just heard a minister for the last hour be locally accountable at delivering local decisions, something that you're wanting to tear apart.
Well, I have to say, and if you look at this over the last year, the evidence bears this out, that every time the DUP's under pressure the ending the union deal, there's going to be media coverage. Paul Given pops up to spend 45 minutes or an hour on the Nolan Show filibustering.
Paul Given popped up because he's a year in place as a minister and offered to be promised a year ago that he would come back.
We'll not waste the time going over it now, but if you look at all of the key moments from the start of this, Paul Given pops up on the Nolan Show to spend an hour filibuster and running the clock down. So, look, the DUP, there may well be an argument for, I don't agree with it, but some people would have said, you know, you need to have Stormont and devolution and all of that, and that's fine. And there's a legitimate, credible argument for that. The issue here is that's not the argument the DUP made. The argument the DUP made was, and if you just give me 40 seconds, I'll just spitfire run through what they said. The RSC border was gone. No, it's not. They've removed that claim themselves. Zero checks and zero customs paperwork. More checks than ever. And even on the Green Lane this week, we find that you have to have customs paperwork. Acts of Union, that was fixed. No, in my case before Christmas, Mr. Justice McAlinden, their constitutional legislation, had no material legal effect. Cut the pipeline of EU law. I don't know what to cut it with, a pair of plastic scissors, because EU law continues to flow long. Storm and break, useless, we found out a week ago. They said they'd got a review if there was no cross community consent in the vote. The government then appoints Lord Murphy, essentially a surrogate of the EU, and then puts in the terms of the evidence that any solutions has to have nationalist consent. They said the protocol...
Lord Murphy would say he's not a surrogate of the EU, and that's not going to be a monologue this morning, so you'd be needing to finish pretty quickly.
Let me finish his 3 points.
It's not going to be a monologue. Hurry up.
Well, they said Northern Ireland's no longer going to be treated as a third country. Yes, we are. So essentially, we could run through this all day. It's better to look at the deal and say what was correct, rather than what was wrong, because everything was wrong in the deal. So the basis upon which they went back was false. That is the issue. This is not a debate about devolution. The issue here is the DUP made claims which were fundamentally false, incorrect.
Well,
and it was always clear they were incorrect. Anybody that looked at the thing could see they were incorrect. Unsustainable claims.
And at the time, Jamie, a year ago, Geoffrey Donaldson was presenting the Safeguarding Union document to his own party. Now, why did you think, and why did people within the DUP, forget about you for a moment, what do you make of the people within the DUP who were so two-faced that they were within the DUP getting all that comes within a political party, and betraying the leadership and the party officers to the extent that we're helping you wire up the meeting?
Well,
what does that say about them?
Well, half of the party officers were totally opposed to this deal. What it says about them to me is they are courageous, brave people who did everything they could to stop what was
doing the dirt on their own party by filtering out what should have been a private meeting.
The people who done the dirt, not only on the party, but on the unionist community, are the people who stood up and told fundamental lies, and no other word will do, lies, which everybody knew at the time was lies. And everybody that supported, and it's very easy, by the way, to blame all of this on Geoffrey Donaldson. He's a convenient scapegoat now because of events as they've transpired. But Gavin Robinson stood shoulder to shoulder with Geoffrey Donaldson. And everybody in the DUP, including half of the party officers who supported that deal, did so with their eyes wide open. They knew. They were told.
No, they had a difference of opinion.
No, Stephen. They knew. They could not know. They were told by senior people in their own party, in writing, what you're saying is untrue. You cannot sustain these claims. The parliamentary party, and the meeting, by the way, where Geoffrey Donaldson instructed the parliamentary party they weren't allowed to talk to me anymore, and 5 minutes later, people in the parliamentary party told me what was said. But in that meeting, Geoffrey Donaldson was pressed by the parliamentary party, go and obtain legal advice on the claims you're making. And they wouldn't. And they couldn't. Because they all knew that this was a conjure and trick from the start. So whatever about Geoffrey Donaldson,
they would deny that. And they would say there was a difference of interpretation. And how can you predict what's going to happen in the future?
There's no difference of interpretation because they themselves, 3 months later, had to concede it was oversold. There's not. And quite often you get on contentious issues, different legal opinions, different views. That happens quite often. Not in this case. There was one legal opinion. We obtained it from John Larkin. The DUP couldn't get a single legal opinion from anybody to contradict that. It was plain to everybody.
Well, you don't know that. You don't know.
No, I do know that.
You suggest that you were so embedded in the DUP that you now know every lawyer they've spoken to. But let me progress this.
Well, can I just answer that point? The parliamentary party asked Geoffrey Donaldson to obtain a legal opinion and produce it for the party. The DUP could not produce a single independent legal opinion.
Let me progress this. How close were you a year ago when this deal was being negotiated with the British government before it was presented to the wider DUP? How close were you to Geoffrey Donaldson? How much foresight were you being given to papers, to government papers, to DUP strategy?
Well, in terms of, there's different periods of time here. It was very close to Geoffrey in respect of in and around the time of the Windsor framework. I don't want to get into too much detail, but you may know a bit about this, and I appreciate you don't get into detail either. But I mean, I met representatives of the European Union, and in that meeting,
on behalf of who?
Well, they were told that the views that I was expressing, that those represented the position of Jeffrey Donaldson. And again, I don't want to get into how you know what I know, but you know, for the benefit of your listeners, so they don't think I'm plucking this out of the sky, you can confirm that absolutely is true. And you know for the fact that is absolutely true. And whatever the DUP would say about it, and look, I don't
so
know.
So you're claiming, let's talk about what you're saying.
I just want to be clear, are you saying that
you were meeting the EU on behalf of the DUP?
No, I'm not saying on behalf of the DUP because I can't stand over.
On behalf of the leader of the DUP?
Jeffrey Donaldson told those people.
The then leader.
Jeffrey Donaldson told those people that the views I expressed represented his position. Now, whether that was the DUP's position is another matter. So I can't say that it was for the DUP because Jeffrey may well have been flying his own kite. So I can't stand over that. But I can stand over, and you know, again, don't get into how, but you can stand over some two sources that's true, that is 100% true, that I met representatives of the European Union and they were told, and I was told, the views I expressed represented Jeffrey's views. A paper went to the Cabinet Office that Jeffrey Donaldson told people in the ERG that represented the DUP position. It went to the Cabinet Office. It was sent to the Prime Minister.
What went to the Cabinet Office?
A paper was put together. I was involved in drafting it, along with lawyers involved in the ERG. Jeffrey Donaldson endorsed that paper. He not only endorsed it to me, he endorsed it to people in the ERG, and he authorised that paper to be sent to the Prime Minister. And that paper was sent to the Prime Minister. And on that night in the Nolan Show, you'll remember the Nolan Show covered that paper, and the DUP then tried to walk back and pretend that, you know, this was just something that they'd seen or come across them. That is untrue. Jeffrey Donaldson authorised that paper to go to the Prime Minister.
So,
for an absolute.
So here's the clear question: both when the DUP are hearing this, some of the MLAs, some of the party members within the DUP this morning, possibly for the first time, the question is, why would the then leader of the DUP, Sir Jeffrey Donaldson, be asking you to speak to the EU on his behalf rather than some of the very senior people within his own party? Why would he be letting you get involved in a document that's going to number 10 rather than keeping it within the DUP? You're not an elected representative.
Because in hindsight, if we look back at it now, in hindsight, I think what was going on was that Jeffrey was more than happy to allow me to fly kites and in some respects, advance deniable suggestions and positions, whatever else. And in parallel to that, the DUP officially and formally. So I suppose it was a deniable channel or a deniable way to float ideas. Unfortunately, what then transpired was that when Jeffrey moved away from those positions, you then had people like me saying, sorry, hang on a minute, you know, what happened to you? You're not the same person that you were 2 months ago.
Listening to this, the former DUP MLA, David McIlvain, is this extraordinary, David?
Good morning, Stephen. Well, I suppose I could maybe start with a slightly facetious point. I mean, we were told when we voted for Brexit that one of the main reasons for doing so was to stop unelected people from having political influence over our country. And having listened to what we've just listened, it seems like we're out of the frying pan and into the fire. So, yes, I think it is astonishing what we're hearing. And I think just highlights probably the bigger issue in that unionism, sadly, is a bit all over the place at the minute. And I think that's something that we really do need to get a hold of, because it's going to create more and more problems for us as we go into
the future. But why did Bryson, David, have so much access to the leader of the DUP at the time, Sir Jeffrey Donaldson? Why?
Well, I think the question is which DUP did he have access to? And I think, again, that comes to the bigger problem, Stephen, in that leaks and things like this only happen whenever there are factions of a political party that feel that their views are not being taken into account. And I think this lack of discipline, I think this lack of real strategic leadership within unionism has been a growing problem for many years now. And this is really just an outworking of that. It's there. I mean, if we go back to the days whenever Ian Paisley was in charge of the DUP, there was very much a sense of a one direction party. It was a party that was united, that was together. Any issues that there were internal issues were handled internally. And I think whenever that binding factor of was taken away from the party, I think ever since that we've seen special advisors running amok. We've seen that with the RHI inquiry. We've seen MLAs going in different directions, speaking in different ways to different people. And really what we're just seeing this morning or hearing this morning is just the outworking of that chaotic approach to how we actually manage ourselves.
It's more than chaos, isn't it? So before MLAs are hearing about party policy, Jimmy Bryson, you're suggesting that the working up of that party policy was partly going through you.
Well, let's just be very clear about what we're saying here. And in terms of that particular document we're talking about, it was a paper drawn up with a suggested way forward, and Jeffrey endorsed that. He didn't only meet me, he met the ERG and endorsed it. You also know that too. And I would like you to be very clear. You know this is true. You know this is true.
Let me put it like this. I have a number of different sources and ways of confirming things, and I would be challenging you and not letting you say things on this program this morning. I'm not taking your word for it. In other words, you're not speaking here in an unfiltered way. I'm listening and I'm fact checking some of the things that you are saying.
Yes. So, sorry, what was the question?
The question, I can't remember what the question was. What was the question? How come was party policy, some of it being filtered through you before DUP MLAs got to it, saw it, were briefed on it?
Well, I think Jeffrey was probably done in two parallel processes. He was probably working with me and using me as a deniable kite flying, which could be denied thereafter, as the DUP tried to do on that very night. So, I mean, look, I'm not saying that all of this was approved by the DUP party officers or even that other people know, because I don't know that. All I can say is what Jeffrey Donaldson knew. That's all I can say. I can't say about anybody else. So I'm not making that claim. I'm not saying that because I don't know who else knew or who didn't know. So it wouldn't be fair to say the DUP, because Jeffrey may have well been flying his own kite.
When the Safeguarding Command paper was being put together, it was not just, you know, the EU, obviously, that was being sussed out. You're talking about number 10. You're talking about the Irish government. Now, had you any interaction with either number 10 or the Irish government?
I think I've gone as far as I'm going to go in respect of all of this, because
it's a yes or no.
No, confidences and et cetera have to be protected. So I've gone as far as fair and reasonable to go, and I'm not going any further on it. So, and that shouldn't be taken either way. But I mean, look, I think it's pretty common knowledge. I think it was in the Belfast Telegraph 2 or 3 weeks ago. I mean, I did have copies of the constitutional legislation and the Storm and Blake legislation.
The draft copies?
Yes.
So for you to have got the draft copies of that legislation...
I didn't get that from the DUP, by the way, to be clear. Well,
that's where I was going. For you to have copies of the draft legislation...
Well, you know I had copies because I was telling you about them at the time.
So you had an in at the British government?
Well, I had copies of the legislation in the Cabinet Office. You know that, because did we not do a thing on the Nolan Show at the time as to what was in the...
Yeah, but when we're summing it up today, David, who on earth... Like, why has this guy got so much access? Why has he got... why is he getting so much documentation? What is going on?
Yeah, well, Stephen, I think your listeners will draw their own conclusion. When somebody who was tweeting out the contents of a private meeting, when asked about their communication with the Irish government, then decides that they want to decide that they use confidence as a reason not to talk about
sorry,
that.
Sorry, hold on.
I think people will draw their own conclusions to that.
Don't be making any insinuations there in respect. No, don't be making any insinuations there, by the way.
Do you respect confidentiality or not, Jimmy? I mean, you can't tweet out the contents of a meeting and then say, sorry.
The meeting wasn't a meeting that I was at in confidence. The senior members, a senior member of the DUP, were wired to the meeting.
Yes, but you were tweeting it. No, you were tweeting the content.
So, well, David, let's just follow this through. That means that any journalist that gets a leak from a political meeting shouldn't report on it. Is that what you're saying? There's no duty of confidence. David, there's no duty of confidence with ISIS for me. I was not in the meeting. Different if I was sitting in the meeting and I was live streaming it and I was breaching the confidence. So be very careful about what you're saying. Don't be accusing me of breaching anybody's confidence.
So,
that's not the case.
So within that meeting, within that meeting that was wired up. Talk us through what actually happened.
Well, the meeting began. This went on for hours. I did make an agreement with the people that I wouldn't share, stream, or repeat whenever people started making contributions from the floor, because that was internal party discussions, that it would be limited to Sir Geoffrey's presentation, and I've been true to that. To that agreement, not least because the audio would identify he was wearing a wire once people start speaking, but that person will never be identified. So Geoffrey opened the meeting. He began his presentation. It was to be a PowerPoint presentation. They then later had to turn the Wi-Fi off to try and block the wire and lost their PowerPoint. But he started with that. I think 5 minutes into the meeting, Geoffrey then said that he believed somebody was. I was posting verbatim, word for word updates off the meeting, and that somebody in the room was texting me. So at that stage, they believed it was text messages. So there was a bit of fury about that. The police officers were accused of being involved, and then so they sent their enforcers up and down the sides of the room to look at who was on their phone, and of course nobody was. So then I think it became apparent maybe 10 minutes later that actually the meeting was being live streamed. The PowerPoint then was turned off at that stage. It went down because of the Wi-Fi. Geoffrey made his presentation, Gavin made some of a presentation, and then there was a lengthy discussion, and senior members of the DUP, some of them gave the speeches of their lives in opposition to this deal. And Geoffrey was told in the room that night, senior people in the DUP made very, very clear, what you're saying is not true.
Well, the party officers at the end of the day supported the party officer mechanism. But they still, by a majority, supported their party, their leader, presenting the case as it was. Now we
almost, by one. A core, I think, was it five? I can't remember the exact numbers now. Five party officers venomously opposed the deal. Five of them.
I think the point here, Jamie, is the party officers, through their mandate within their party, the whole structure of the DUP ultimately has a public mandate from the electorate to do what they do. And here's you kind of laughing about bugging their meetings. Your sole design is to bring down Stormont, isn't it? And to destroy that local accountability. And some people might think you should not have the amount of power you have. And that leave it to the elected representatives.
Well, that's, people want to take that view, they can take that view. But my position has always been very, very clear. Sam McBride wrote a great article in the Belfast Telegraph about all of this in the days after. Nobody should have been shocked that I would do everything possible to bring down that deal, because that's what I always said I would do.
Yeah.
Nobody
can. And you failed.
I think the deal fell apart, has it not? I mean, is there anybody?
Stormont's up and running.
And that's to the shame of the DUP. And that whatever about what the DUP want to say, whatever about what they want to say, here is a cold, hard legal fact. The DUP are Irish sea border implementers as a matter of law. And whatever they say about it, that is the position. That is what they're doing. And will it be this
month?
That's
not a fact. That's a political statement from you.
Sorry, that is a matter of fact. As a matter of law, they're bound by Section 7A of the 2018 Act. The DUP ministers are implementing the Irish Sea Border. That is not a political opinion. That is a matter, an uncontestable matter of legal fact.
Yeah, and David,
established
and
in
David
the High
Graham,
Court.
Obviously a more rounded discussion would include, no matter what the DUP did, sorry, David McIlvaine, what would be in place today even if the DUP hadn't have agreed to that deal? Where was Northern Ireland heading? What was the British government of the day going to do anyway, given the relationship that they need to maintain on behalf of their GB constituents and indeed the EU?
Yeah, I mean, look, the argument that Jimmy makes, it just doesn't stack up, because, I mean, at the other side, Sinn Féin are implementing his Majesty's law every day in their positions in the executive. It's the first paragraph in every piece of legislation that it's enacted through His Majesty's government. So, I mean, at the end of the day, Jimmy's in a very privileged position, not because of the information that he's getting from his leaks, but from the fact that he's in opposition. He's not accountable. He's not given the job of governing. And it's a real privilege to be able to speak from opposition. But the bottom line is that when you are elected democratically to govern, it is your job to govern. And unfortunately, when it comes to the bigger issue of bringing down Stormont or not bringing down Stormont, the people who want to bring down Stormont, when they're asked one simple question, they can never give the answer. And that is, what do we do with the people who voted for it? What do we do with the people who voted for devolution, voted for it to go for government to be happening, locally accountable ministers? And I at times have been the DUP's fiercest critic, Stephen, but I do have huge sympathy for the fact that they are there to govern. That is the responsibility they've been given.
And Jimmy, the bottom line is, no matter how much access you had to the top of the DUP, no matter how many people you had in the DUP helping you wire their own meeting, those people have stayed within the party and are now loyal to Gavin Robinson, aren't they?
Well, we'll see how things transpire. Look, would I have liked to see people in the DUP launch a much greater rebellion? Yep, I absolutely would have, and they should have, but they chose not to do so, and they chose to play the long game. That's a matter for them. I don't particularly like long games. I like, to bring the house down there and then. So some people take a different view and want to play the long game, and we'll see how that transpires. But my view is that a full-blown rebellion against Donaldson should have happened at the time. There was a bit
and
of
there's
a,
no hint of any type of rebellion against Gavin Robinson, who you say was standing shoulder to shoulder with Geoffrey Donaldson with his political objective of bringing Northern Ireland forward.
Well, I think, to be fair, Gavin is a very likeable individual. He's very well liked across the DUP. And to be fair, even those who oppose the deal and oppose Gavin's involvement in the deal, I think there's a degree of personal respect for Gavin. I think he's, I really disagree with him on the deal. I think he's tried to walk it back without embarrassing the party. But I think Gavin knows deep down, what they did was wrong. They're not even really particularly defending it anymore. Gavin's statement now talks about the DUP's mandate is to remove the Irish Sea Border and end the application of EU law. I mean, that's the very thing Gavin told us he did this time last year.
Final word to you, David.
Well, I mean, I think we can possibly find somewhere to agree at the end of this, Stephen, in that I think Gavin, to be fair, has brought a new sense of togetherness with the party. And I think that's needed, because I think the more the party fragments, the more the party divides, the more we play into the hands of those who want to destroy unionism. And I think, as we've listened to the last half an hour, I think people will make their own judgments as to where the biggest threat to unionism actually lies.
And where's that?
Fragmented unionism.
Is that how you consider you and people who support you, Jimmy?
Absolutely not. We are principled unionists who, we haven't changed. I haven't changed. Jim Allister hasn't changed. Our unalterable opposition to the protocol remains in the Irish Sea border. I'm not the one implementing the border in the Irish Sea, the DUP are.
Okay, Jimmy Bryson and David McElveen. Of course, the DUP would say they're trying to stop everything about any Irish Sea border. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. See you in the morning.
Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Stephen Nolan Show.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.